stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with keyboardist, arranger, composer, teacher, the adorable, charming, exuberant, and amazingly talented Gwen Wamin. Gwen discovered her fascination with music at 4 when she begged to take piano lessons. Listen to her talk about how she had to wait and how she felt when she finally could get her little hands on the piano. But piano was not enough. Saxophone, a professional dancer by the time she was 15, Gwen Wamin is a woman of passion. And her story is fascinating because you can hear how her life was driven by her passions. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you're supposed to be, or the person you think you have to be, or the person somebody told you you ought to be. Not even the person other people seem to be, but the person you really are. This may seem ironic. You may be thinking, how can I be other than I really am? But as a therapist, it is clear to me that many too many of us are acting out lives that are maybe barely who we really are. And in denial for or hiding aspects of ourselves, which for one reason or another, we learned were not going to get us what we wanted or needed. Too many of us in childhood learn that some quality about us, something that we can't help being, like what we look like or sound like, something that we're attracted to, like an interest that we have, or a curiosity, or a talent. Something about us is going to bring a consequence that we really don't want. It's going to bring criticism, or teasing, or sometimes punishment, sometimes even abuse. These reactions can come to us, and do come to many, from their family of origin. But schools, teachers, peers, religious organizations, cultural organizations also have the power to make some of us feel that we are not all right, or that something about us is not all right. And since we are amazingly capable as human beings, we are able quite often to first pretend we are not like that. I straighten my hair because curly hair is unattractive in my group, or the other way around. Or I don't laugh out loud because my friends think I have a funny laugh and they laugh at me when I laugh. So we begin to pretend to alter things about us. No, I really don't like to read. I begin to read under the covers with a flashlight because reading doesn't go down that well with my friends or my family. Any number of things. It doesn't matter what it is. If we believe that it is unattractive or it will bring a consequence we don't like, we can begin to try and alter it. And if we work at it hard enough, and this happens to many too many of us, we finally forget. We forget that we can laugh out loud. We forget the joy of reading. We forget we forget something important about ourselves. And then we come into adulthood without access to some of the important things about us. That is unfortunate, since I believe that living the fullest life we can live, the life that is the most reflective of who we are, is what we are all entitled to. But in addition to that, if you're hiding something about yourself, then that something didn't go away. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I talk about the kinds of things that we hide as having gone undercover and the things that we present as being our cover story. The Lynn Show is about saying that if this happened to you, if you believe that you are in denial for or hiding something that you would want to get back, or even that there's something you always wanted to do but somehow never felt able to risk, and you want to talk to me about that, please go up on my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Click the email tab, ask me any questions you might have. I'll be glad to answer them. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And in this show, my interview with Gwen Wellman is a perfect example of what it looks like, what it sounds like when you are someone who responds to who you really are and pursues what turns you on. Gwen's story is the story of a young woman who understood the power that music would have in her life and also understood the joy and the passion that she could achieve from dance and became able to make choices that were based on who she really is. It's a lovely story. And before I play Gwen's interview, I'm going to play a cut from her CD. This cut is called The Heart Is My Home. The CD is called Certitude, and we're going to go out on the title tune from this CD. You'll hear her talk about it in the interview. So here now is the very talented Gwen Wellman.
My place of revelation. use it for my manifestation. The spirit is my place of revelation. Cleanse it for my manifestation.
With Gwen Wellman, and I'm explaining to Gwen that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And as I understand it, the art to which you are giving your life and making your living is singing, music?
No, actually playing jazz. And
playing jazz and composing.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I got that all wrong. You're a composer.
And a pianist.
And
yes.
A pianist.
And an arranger.
And an arranger.
And an educator.
Good. Okay, good. So the only thing I got right was that it has to do with music.
Yes.
All right, great. So I only ask one question, and it is, do you remember the very first time in your life that music became interesting to you, called to you, was something you thought you might like to have more of, anything like that?
Well, first thing that comes to mind is when I was about 4 and a half, I had my first piano lesson.
Okay, so now wait. Did you ask for a piano lesson? You did? Do you remember? Or do you know why you asked?
Well, I liked the music, but I went for my first lesson at 4 and a half, and I was told that my motor skills, usually 5 was the age to start, and I needed to wait about 6 months before I could have a lesson, so I was waiting and waiting and waiting. So when I got back at that piano at 5, I was like, let me at it.
Really?
Yeah.
So, well, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Because lots of kids take lessons, they don't particularly like it.
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, clearly.
And mother used to say, she said I was the only kid she knew who she didn't have to ask to practice.
Yes, yeah. And that's, of course, the point I was trying to make, is that young... that's unusual. So, okay, so you got at this with a vengeance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you took lessons forever? You took lessons
forever.
From
5 till just a few years ago. It's really great. It's an endless study. You know, for the rest of my life, I'm going to be learning and developing this gift because it's... talent is what you start out with, not end up with, was something my teacher always used to say. And it's endless, you know, what you can learn and how you can grow and develop it.
Well, all right. Okay, so you start playing at 5. I'm assuming it's classical music that you're learning.
Being in New York, my first teacher was actually a classical jazz, classical and jazz pianist. She was married to an arranger for, I think it was Chico Hamilton.
Yeah.
And he was Oscar Hymas, and she was Ann Hymas. And she taught me blues at the very beginning, and jazz harmony at the beginning, and classical at the beginning. She taught me to compose at the beginning.
How did she do that?
very carefully. But she was so good with children. And she, you know, introduced the blues scale at probably the very beginning. And
that's such an interesting thing. I mean, I think that's quite unusual, don't you?
I don't know, because I only know my own experience, but I guess it's one of the bounties of growing up in New York.
Yes.
You know, which is kind of a jazz town. And,
yeah, right. But
I think I wrote my first blues, my first composition, my first blues, I think, was when I was 9.
Really?
Yeah.
So, okay, so you started writing. Well, you said she taught you composition.
Yeah.
So very early, she was interested in exposing you to a variety of different styles and also to the possibility of composing.
Yes, and she really loves music. She conveyed that love of music to me and the fun of it, and she loved children. She finds children fascinating, so she really listened and related, and there was a real exploration of music in
yeah.
these lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really
wow. So she gave you the idea that your ideas, that what you thought, that what you made of it were important.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just that she was telling you and you were receiving.
Yes.
Right? It was
exactly.
an interaction.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great. Okay. Yeah. All right. So you're playing and you're playing and you're 9 and you're playing. Did you play in school? Did you?
Yeah. I played saxophone, alto sax, I think it was from about age 9 on through high school.
Why did that happen?
Just, it was an opportunity, and I liked the saxophone, and I loved music, and
so you had, was it orchestra, was it chorus?
I was also in, singing in, I think it was a glee club in school.
Uh-huh.
And,
so you sang as well.
Glee Club was famous, like, for this TV show.
Right.
No, but popular, whatever. We played in symphony band, junior high school symphony band, high school symphony band.
Okay, so your life is already
jazz band too, yeah.
Your life is already pretty much about music now.
Well,
right?
It's funny, actually. I was also a dancer at the time. You know, kind of typical New York kid, you get exposed to a lot of art stuff. So I actually was a professional dancer at 15.
Tell me about that.
Well, I started ballet also at 4. I didn't like it. I hated it. And then went back at 7, and then I liked it. And then because...
No.
Oh.
Again, you know, you say, you know, New York kids get exposed to a lot of things. So did your parents put you in ballet?
Yes, because we had a whole... My mother's an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And she had many friends that were actors, and we had a kind of a community, a small little town within a town, of actor families, and all the kids, we were all friends. And Harriet had been a ballet dancer. She was from New York, and she got all of us kids into ballet.
I see. So but at 4, you didn't like it. Do you remember why?
There were two things I remember. One was we had to do something with scarves, and I didn't like. And then there was another thing where you had to sit in a position like this with your feet together and your
knees out.
And I had natural turnout, and we had to flop our things. And I was the only one in the class whose legs kept hitting the ground. It was like bonk, 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 because I was so flexible.
Right.
But
well, that was the good news.
Looking at me, I know. But everyone was like, what's wrong with it? Why is she making so much? And it made me embarrassed.
That's very funny, because you were doing, although that's hilarious.
Isn't that funny?
Right, yeah, right.
That's what is. It's good to be turned out, but at 4, I didn't know, you know.
No, well, you'd think the teacher would have said something,
think, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what made you go back at 7?
Well, I guess everyone, our whole, you know, crew of friends were doing it, and it was great exercise, and I enjoyed it, you know, and it was great, got to hear great classical music while I did it, and
mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. I got to study for years at the New York School of Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
John Boy's father, you know, Granite,
yeah.
Richard Thomas,
uh-huh.
and Daniel Levin's an excellent, amazing teacher, and both of them great teachers, very inspiring. You know, they had such a high standard of perfection and expertise that kind of that helped mold my character that
mm-hmm.
applies everywhere, I feel like, you know. So I felt like it was good, very valuable time spent
So you had some wonderful teachers.
Very.
Yeah, I mean, you had teachers who gave you the joy of the thing and the rigor of the thing, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you
know, the discipline and the discipline, expectation.
Right. Yeah.
And the belief in yourself. Mr. Thomas used to say, you know, you can achieve anything. Like he said, if you want to do 10 pirouettes, you can do it. He's at 12, 14. You know, and it really installed a sense of capability in your belief in yourself, which is valuable.
Okay, so, at some point, did you say to yourself, I'd like to make dance a life, I'd like to make music a life,
Well, there was a woman, a wonderful dancer named Christine Sari. What happened was, remember Zabar's? On 83rd.
That's for those of you who haven't been to New York. Zabar's, the quintessential, I don't even know what to call it.
The motherland, the mother.
Yeah, right. It's a deli, grocery, but with, it's, I don't know
how
to explain
everything.
It has everything,
so many
right.
Gourmet
right,
foods.
Right, right, right,
it's
right,
the
right.
Place right. For right. Great food for right. All kinds of events.
Right.
Well, they were taking over a lot of the real estate in the area because for some reason the rents were getting higher and higher and higher. And so where Barnes & Noble's now is on 83rd and Broadway, that's where the studio used to be. So they closed, and I think it was around 86, because they could no longer make the rent.
Right.
So I had to go to Elliott Feld. I didn't have to, but I chose to go to Elliott Feld.
That's another teacher at another Batten, right?
But they were all connected, because Elliott Feld had been, a dance troupe with Levins and Thomas. They all knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Christine Sari, who had been at the other school, was also at Elliott Feld. So I went over there, and at the time I was in Stuyvesant High School, which is pretty demanding homework-wise.
Yeah, academically.
Academically,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ballet school was requiring 6 days a week of me, all day Saturday, for classes and workshops and partnering to prepare you for dancing in, you know, their company. And Stuyvesant was overwhelmingly a high load of work.
Right.
And so sometimes I was having to say I can't come in Saturday because I've got these works. And so Christine said to me at one point, she was 16 years old, she said, I need you to ask yourself, do you love this? Because in order to make this a career, you have to love it.
Yeah. You know? Because you have to give it what it requires.
Right, and you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot because dancers, you know, sometimes it's, you don't know what it's going to be financially and this and that. And it requires a lot of dedication, and I know because I did it my whole life up until that point. But also I had these two different demands. So she said, you're going to have to make a choice. No, that was not what she said. She said, I want you to ask yourself, do you love it? And is this something you want to do? And so I thought about that for months and months and months and months. And finally...
I don't think that that's an easy...
It's not.
No, I don't think that's an easy question to answer. And I think it's possible to answer, I love this, but am unable to give it what it requires.
That, yes. And it's hard at 16 to make a life choice for your...
your
career and what you... But it finally came down to one point, because I wouldn't have been doing it if I didn't love it and enjoy it.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? But at one point, I was doing a plié during class, and I looked outside, and I saw all the people and just life happening out there. And some overwhelming feeling came over me and thought, it was like, do I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? Just
yeah.
This, when there's all that I could... And something in me just said, you know what? No.
That's great. It's great. It's great that I'm always interested in, you know, how people come to know who they are.
Mm.
Because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like at that moment, you became aware of something significant to you, essential to you, that could not be addressed by dance. You know, however much fun it was, however much you loved it, however good you were at it, that's another, I think, important thing.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you. Yeah, I got chills when you said that because I think that is really true. And I think my first love really was music, because I never, like the other dancers, I never said, let's watch a ballet. You know, I loved watching Baryshnikov, who doesn't?
Right.
Or Nureyev, but I never was like, let's go study some choreography and some dancing, which dancers love to do.
Yeah, right.
You know? But music, I can listen to that and transcribe it. What did that saxophone player play? What was that line?
Wow.
You know, so I feel like it might have been, my first love might have been more for music.
Okay, so that what you haven't said is that, although, well, you did, sort of, you implied, I just don't know where it could be, that with 6 days a week dance and Stuyvesant, you know, requirements, when were you doing music?
I didn't get much sleep in childhood.
Because you were continuing to study, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
And I mean, you were practicing and you were composing, I'm assuming, and right?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And sometimes I would play piano even at the ballet studio. I would sneak into a studio where there was no one, you know, no class, and there was a piano right there.
Wow.
So I'd practice in there. So.
Okay, so when you had the epiphany, right, life, it sounds like it was not specific. Not this. This is not going to be enough, the dance.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. The unknown.
What?
The unknown.
The unknown, right. There is something.
Yes.
That I could want or even do want, even if I'm not clear about what it is.
Yeah. It was the mystery and the adventure and the wonder. Yeah. Of all that's out there for me to explore and be inspired by. And
yeah, yeah. The possibilities, the opportunities.
For your life. Yeah.
For your life, right, right. Life,
yeah. And
right?
I think I made the right choice.
Well, good. Okay, I'm very glad. Okay, so at that point, did you say to, what was her name?
Christine. Sorry. Yeah, right? I said to her and I thanked her. I really thanked her. I wrote her a long thank you note, you know, because how fortunate that she was able to guide me that early.
Yeah.
You know, to help me get on my path, which I do believe is music.
She must have thought you had the possibility of being a dancer.
Oh, they definitely did, because they put me on full scholarship from the time I was seven. And I felt an obligation, because we didn't have to pay a dime.
Wow.
All those years.
Right.
And I felt they had invested so much in me.
Right.
That I felt I had to. That's actually why I said before I had to go to Elliott Field. I didn't have to, but
right.
I felt I did.
Yes. So two things here. One is that clearly that is why she asked you this. You know, why she presented this. She would probably be presenting this to everybody if she, you know, because she must have thought, they must have thought, that you were a potential dancer in life, right? Okay, you're right. So she asked you that. But the other thing, it is that how brave it was, really, to say, no, this isn't going to be enough for me at 16, to be willing to say that, given the pressure of they've invested so much in me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very brave.
Well, thank you. It may have helped. And thank you for saying that, because then it helps me appreciate the school closing, because it was actually pretty traumatic that the school closed, because we had gone away for the summer, came back, and the doors were closed. Couldn't even get into the studio, nothing. And it was a shock, and all that was left was this little corner of the studio where the rosin box was. And I went down the stairs in the basement just so I could see that one little, not the basement, you know, the second floor, see that rosin box, because that's all I could find of this home. It was like a second home. But that relieved a little bit of the pressure, because that school had closed.
Yes. Oh, yes, I do.
So I can see now maybe the blessing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. It's like the universe said, okay, I'm going to take this away, right, as an obligation in a way, right?
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, that worked out for you. Right. Okay, good. So you're 16 and you say, not dance.
Right.
So are you thinking music? Are you saying, well, you know, actually what I want to do is have a life of music, or you're not doing that?
Well, I'm still doing music. Never drop music.
So yeah, but that's not the same as I've decided, right?
What happened was my mother, who's very active in volunteer work, she had been at an AFS benefit. And she knew that I loved, you know, blues and jazz and stuff. And she, there was a jazz drummer there named Eddie Locke.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great, amazing jazz musician. And he had recommended my, who became my teacher for 25 years, Mike Longo, who had been Dizzy Gillespie's pianist and musical director for years. And he suggested that I call him, gave the number to my mother. So I was about, I think I was 17 by that point. And she said, you know, you might want to call him. He's, you know, really great. And I was a little scared because, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right.
So I didn't do it right away. And Eddie Locke called me one day and said, have you called Mike yet? No, not yet. And finally I called him, you know, maybe a month or two later. And I had my first lesson with him. And I was so happy afterwards, I was actually skipping. Elated. I was blissful. So happy. And also, his belief in me. He told me, actually, it was funny, because I was 17, his first question to me was, what is jazz? And I said, you know, jazz. And he kind of looked at me like, uh-oh, who's this? Young teenager. And he said, well, jazz is a marriage between African rhythmic and melodic principles and European harmonic and melodic principles. And I was like, wow, this guy's deep. And he is. And he handed me a drum. And he said, play this. And he played a rhythm. And I could play it. And then he said, okay, now play this.
Mm-hmm.
And he handed it to me. And I could do it. And he started to look like this.
And
he said, okay, now do this. And he handed it to me. And I did it again. And he went, okay, come back next week.
Really?
Yeah, and then he told me years later that there's very few people that can do all those in one lesson.
Wow.
And so that made me feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, so again, are you thinking, I want to make my life in music? Or are you not thinking anything? Are you just sort of putting one foot in front of the other?
I think the choice about what to do it as a career started to be kind of simultaneous because I was, I think at 17, starting to think of where am I going to college and what am I going to be studying and what for.
Okay, so you're thinking about college. So what are you thinking?
So I'm thinking I want to go study jazz. You know, Mike has all this belief in me and I'm loving everything he's teaching me. I'm eating every morsel up. And that drum rhythm, that drum put my head in such a blissful place. So happy. It's called the African hemiola, and it's this joining of meters. The interesting thing about jazz is the time conception is totally different from classical because there's more than one meter happening at once. It's polymetric, polymodal, polypulsative music. Which means that if you know anything about music, you know in classical, if you have a waltz, you're playing in 3/4 time.
Right.
If you are playing a march, you're playing in 4/4 time. But in jazz, you're in 3/4, 4/4, 6/8, 5/4, 7/4, all at once.
Now, are you saying that that it changes periodically? No,
that's what's interesting, is that it's all happening at the same time. So, for instance, they all go together. So you can have... The only way I can think of to explain it is to actually play it.
Go ahead.
So here's 6/8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That would be 6/8. Now, if I would say 4/4 time over that, it would be 1, 2, 3, 4. Now you got 2 meters. 6/8 and 4/4. Now check this out. My foot's going to do 4/4. My hands are going to do 6/8, but I'm going to say 3/4. This is going to be 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
Oh my
three,
God!
1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
Wow!
Isn't that cool?
Yes.
So what happens is when all those meters lock up, it puts your head in this really blissful, happy place.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and that's why if you listen to like all the greats playing, you'll hear them go to different meters. Like for in one moment, the bass player might be playing in 4/4, and the piano player might be playing in 3/4, but it all gels. It all goes, fits.
It fits. Wow, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So did he teach you that?
Yes. He taught me that. That first day he taught me with that drum. And then he would give warm-ups that would help put it locks up something in your hands, and then you would get a warm-up that would help put that on the piano. And it affects your swing, it affects your phrasing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really an amazing aspect of jazz. And it came from, really, Mike learned it from Dizzy. Because Dizzy, Chano Pozo, was a Cuban drummer, I think, and he taught, he knew that drum stuff, and he shared it with Dizzy, and Dizzy shared it with Mike on the bandstand.
Watch this!
Yeah, and through their music.
Yeah, right.
And then Mike shared it with us, but he broke it down with the warm-ups in a way that Dizzy never did. Dizzy just taught Mike on the bandstand, like, yeah, on the gig.
Right, right.
But he was able to, Mike is brilliant, he was able to change it into little morsels.
Yeah, he was able to, as you say, break it down.
Yeah.
Not just what it was, but to put it in pieces.
Mm, exactly, yeah. Right? Which you could digest over time.
Yeah.
That would change your playing and help your playing evolve over time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Amazing teacher.
Okay,
amazing.
So you're studying with him. Now, you're 17. So have you made your decision about college, or you're...
Finally, yeah, I decided to go. Well, I was also 17. I always loved the sun.
The sun. I see. Okay, good.
And when I found out the University of Miami had a jazz department, I said, I'm going there. And he tried to tell me, you know, man, New York is the jazz capital of the world. I said, I know, but I'm just going for college. And he wanted me to stay an extra year because I had just started studying with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had only been a short time.
Yeah.
And he thought I needed a little more study before I went off to college. Because a lot of people that go to jazz departments, they've already been, you know, very serious with jazz since they were, you know, maybe 10 or,
yeah, right,
you know,
right,
they're
right
on a certain level. And I was not on that level yet.
What year was this?
When did I go? Was it 1988?
Okay.
It was my first semester. And, I managed to get in, I guess because they saw my talent.
So you auditioned?
I had to send an audition tape, I believe. And when I got there, I found it was very sterile. I had never lived in Florida, you know, and I'm from New York, mm-hmm, and I felt like I was in a hospital for some reason every day. And I just was like, man, you know, I don't think this is the place, the ideal place to develop.
You.
For me.
Yeah.
For other people, it may be.
Okay, so how long? So I'm assuming you didn't stay.
No, I left after the first semester. And second semester, I think I was at Manhattan School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And third semester, I think I took a year off just to study with Mike,
mm-hmm,
and then I went to City College because Ron Carter was there.
Mm.
Yeah, and I auditioned, and I got to be in his ensemble.
Oh,
and yeah, he was so sweet. I was so scared to audition for him, and afterwards he said, are you going to be in my ensemble?
Aww.
And I was like, I hope so. Like, I hope so too. And I was like, oh, thank you. So he was amazing too. He had, talk about a high standard. He had a really high standard too. And he would not tolerate lateness.
I see.
It was so important to be on time. I remember one time we had a... a jazz saxophone player from Japan named Hiro.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to him, Hiro, you're my hero. But if you're late one more time, you ain't gonna be nothing but a sandwich.
Hiro probably didn't get the joke.
No, he got it. It was funny.
Well, all right. So you're bouncing around here from the, you know, one learning opportunity to another, right?
Yeah, pretty blessed, right?
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. But are you thinking what you're going to do with it? Or are you just glad to be doing it?
Well, I guess because Mike told me from early on that Dizzy said, if you take care of your music will take care of you.
Okay.
So my focus was just
to play well.
Music. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Just try to improve and learn about the music and try to grow and be as develop it as much as I can and learn as much as I can. I was not thinking about the business.
So what happened?
I just kept doing it. 1991. I was still in college, and Ben Brown, another great, had played with Dizzy, great bass player, amazing mm-hmm. person, one of my favorite people on the planet. Beautiful, amazing, spiritual person, and his wife as well. He's so dedicated to his wife, he has 4 wedding rings on. Isn't that great? Uh-huh. And he's such a great bass player. He played with Dizzy, first started playing with Dizzy, I think when he was like 18.
Oh.
He's such a talented person and so giving. Anyway, he was playing with another student of Mike's, guitar player named Adam Rafferty, at a place called Cameos. At that time, it was on the second floor in around 67th, I think, in Columbus, or 61st, I forget. Anyway, we went there, and I was playing there at least 4 times a week with them every night, getting to play with, you know, great musicians. And that's a huge part of the knowledge, because Mike always said, like, 95% of music is experiential knowledge, 5% intellectual. So that experience of playing with that kind of bass player, and they were so supportive, you know, being with the right people, too, that encourage you, they're
right.
supportive,
right.
don't have big egos. You know, that was a huge blessing. And then that led to more work down the line, you know, word of mouth kind of.
So you're saying that you developed a career, a kind of a gigging career.
Yeah, I started to get work. Mike recommended me for some things. I remember I did my first cruise. And that was really fun. I loved seeing the dolphins. But and at the same time, I was composing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And teaching.
Teaching?
Yeah.
Individually? Privately.
Yep, I taught privately, and then around 2002, I think it was, I taught at a couple schools. I taught at the Music Stop, the Parkside School. There's Memory Lane, I'm trying to remember.
It's all right, that's not important. It's not okay. important. So you're playing, and you're teaching, and you're writing.
Yes.
And you're recording?
Yes. We recorded a lot of demos, because a lot of places that booked international stuff, you had to send them demos. So over the years, I got a lot of experience recording for that purpose, but I didn't feel like I was ready or wanted to put out a record.
Right.
You know. But
so when you're saying you recorded standard stuff so that to show you as a performer, as a player.
Yeah.
Right.
We would do like trio, quartet kind mm-hmm. of stuff.
Right.
And
we...
Oh...
A variety of people you recorded with.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, people that we were gigging with and playing with and mm-hmm. knew each other over the years. All great musicians. New York, you know, has such a great pool.
Yeah, right.
And I went, you know, played jam sessions and stuff. Cleopatra's Needle was great. Lots of great musicians came through there. But I was composing also. I got very into composing... When I became a Baha'i, because when I read the prayers and I read the writings, I would hear a song. I would hear them. I'd mm-hmm. start singing them, and it was coming through me. It wasn't coming from me. It was a very inspirational process. And so I would just go to write to the piano from that melody that I just heard. And that was a different kind of composing than I had experienced before.
The other being more intellectual.
Well, not intellectual, but more of me in it.
Mm-hmm.
This is more of me being like a hollow reed and it coming through me,
mm-hmm.
which was, it's funny because the only way I could explain it to people is like, it's kind of like vomiting. And I was like, because I've never experienced giving birth. I've never had a child.
Right.
But then I couldn't believe it. I went to see Sting at a concert he was giving in New York, and it was either at the concert or in an interview, he said, it was like, for the last ship, he said it was like projectile vomiting. I said, yes, that's exactly what I think. I'm not alone in that. But it's really, like, sometimes it would be at an inconvenient time. Like, I need to go out to the appointment. I'm like, really? Right now?
Now.
But you gotta get it, you know, when it's there. But yeah, that's what I guess led to that CD.
This one?
Yes.
Okay, this CD, which is Certitude.
Yeah.
Four-piece, F-O-U-R-P-E-A-C-E.
Yeah, we're a four-piece band.
Yeah.
That plays four-piece, so it's a play on words.
Very, very cute. Very cute. So you did this in New York?
Yeah, and actually we did not have an intention of doing a CD. Someone had said, you know, had suggested that I send some songs into the ISSC competition.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a songwriting competition.
Yeah.
And we were just doing a couple of recordings at the Baha'i Center. And somebody heard them and said, wow, I love your tunes. Could you put them in a CD? I said, oh, really? I said, I hadn't thought of it. She said, yeah, why don't you do that? I'd love to get a copy. Okay. So we put it. It wasn't designed for that. The arrangements weren't designed for that. So there aren't that many solos. There's only like one that has one or two that have solos on it. But it still is good arrangements and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
good music.
Well, yeah. So when did you do this?
When did I do that? 2011, I think we recorded it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are you living in Sarasota now?
Kind of. I'm back and forth. I go back to New York.
Well, January, what brought you here?
I come back. Lewis. Actually, our friend Lewis.
Really?
Yeah, he had told my mother about some great... I was on the other coast. I was in Miami playing some gigs over there in Fort Lauderdale. And he said, well, tell Gwen to go over to the West Coast. There's a lot more opportunities over there. And not opportunities. He said Fort Myers, Naples is great. And he said, and he had some contacts over here.
Right.
He wanted me to meet.
Yeah.
So he, on his advice, I said, well, let me go check it out. Then I found out a family friend of ours lived down here in Sarasota. They weren't using their home. And they said, well, why don't you rent it out for real cheap? And
mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yeah, so I got to explore it, and then I met such lovely people here, and it's so beautiful. And it's,
and we have the sun mostly.
But the cold is not so good right now, so I'm enjoying the warm weather.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, sorry about today then.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, so...
It's not -3.
So, do you want to tell us what's coming up for you?
Yeah, one thing, I have an international gig that seems to be coming up for 2017. Those details are still getting worked out. And I'm going to be playing at the Glen Ridge in January.
When?
We're still finalizing the date. It's either going to be the 6th, the 13th, or I think the 27th.
Well, you'll let me know.
Yeah, sure.
And is it a solo gig? Are you playing?
No, duo. Great bass player. Played with everybody. Clark Terry, Illinois Duquette. Fred Hunter.
Hmm. Is he local?
Yeah, he's actually from New York.
Ah.
And what's so funny is he moved around the same time as I did last year, but we didn't know it. And then in the spring, we just happened to connect, and he has just moved down here. So he actually knows. We know all the same people back in New York.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that great? Oh, and I know one other thing.
Yeah.
I'm teaching right now. We're starting a jazz department at the Sarasota Conservatory. I teach over there, and we have about 9 courses that we're offering. Systematic harmonic substitution, voice leading, theory, improvisation, ear training, you know, theory, a lot of different courses, and some ensemble classes. And Fred is going to be teaching possibly the ensemble class and some jazz history. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, we're hoping that we can have some... anyone from any field, whether it's pop, rock, classical, you know, if they're interested, because really jazz carries over to all those fields.
So are you taking beginning students? Or
Sure, all levels. All levels and all ages. From 5 to 85.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so do you have you'll give me the information, the number, or how to get in touch with you for all of that,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Good. Okay, good. So I only have one more question,
okay.
And it is... having given a life to music, which you have given a life, you have given other things priority in your life as well, but music is clearly a through line. What would you say about what it's like to give your life to music?
I would say for sure you get back way more than you give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's what keeps me on the planet. I mean, it's so much joy from it. Nothing makes me happier. And it's like spiritual food.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Gwen.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, it keeps her on the planet. Yes. So you get more than you give. Of course, this is what it sounds like when you're listening to someone who is exactly who she is. And it is my hope that when you listen to Gwen, hearing what it sounds like to be so connected to your very essence and what is there, I hope that you're asking yourself, is this how I feel about my life? Do I wake up every morning delighted to be in the life that I'm in? Do I know what is necessary to keep me on the planet? And am I nurturing that? And of course, if the answer to that is no, and you'd like to talk to me about that, please do go up on my website, again, thelynshow.com. And as always, I hope that you heard something from this show that you can use. Something that inspired you to ask the questions of yourself, to pursue the real you, to ask yourself if you're living out a cover story or if it is the real you. And if not, to maybe want to do something about that. And perhaps study with Gwen or one of the other teachers at the Sarasota Music Conservatory. And you can find that information at thesarasotamusicconservatory.org/jazz. And something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
Blast of knowledge will awaken the heart, will awaken the soul, will awaken the spirit from the slumber of heedlessness. The trumpet blast of knowledge will awaken the heart, awaken the soul, will awaken the spirit from the slumber of heedlessness. Then will the manifold favor. The seeker, that he will find himself endowed with a new eye, find himself endowed with a new ear, find himself endowed with a new heart, find himself endowed with a new. The manifest signs of the universe. Then he will discover the hidden mysteries of the soul. Gazing with the eye of God, he will perceive. station.
Some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may